WNYC Studios is brought to you by ZBiotics. Seize the day after a night of drinks with ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink. ZBiotics was invented by PhD scientists to break down the byproduct of alcohol, which is most responsible for making you feel crummy the next day. Drink ZBiotics before your first drink, drink responsibly, and you'll wake up refreshed and ready to take on the day. Try it for yourself at ZBiotics.com/WNYC and get 15% off your first order when you use WNYC at checkout. That's ZBiotics.com/WNYC and use the code WNYC at checkout for 15% off.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Good morning. Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer. 20 years ago, astronaut and Dr. Mae Jemison became the first woman of color in space as part of a mission aboard the Space Shuttle Endeavour. But in her time back on Earth, she's been working to take us even further, all the way to the stars. Earlier this year, she was awarded a grant from DARPA, that's the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency, to establish a long-term project known as the 100-Year Starship, with the goal of achieving interstellar travel by 2112. She's here now to tell us how we could finally reach the stars and share a little bit about her own journey. Dr. Mae Jemison, welcome back to WNYC.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm excited to be here and all the things that we have to look forward to.
So we put a man or a human being on the moon decades ago. There's a rover on Mars as we speak. Why is interstellar travel so much harder?
Interstellar travel is so much harder because the distances are greater. And you actually, right now, we actually don't know what exists between our solar system and the next star system. So there are a lot of pieces that have to be done. Let's think about the distance. We're really, one of the things I'm most excited about in terms of human space exploration is the Voyager, you know, being almost outside of our solar system. It's been traveling since 1977, going over 17,000 miles per hour. And in that time, it's only gone the equivalent of a mile if we were trying to travel between a star that was as far away from California as New York City is. That is, it's only traveled a mile. It would take us 70,000 years to get to the closest star system if we were going at the speed Voyager is going. So it means we have to go really, really fast.
So,
right?
So what are we talking about here? The warp speed or, you know, sort of the...
Well, we're looking at, you know, first of all, creating a lot more energy, a lot more propulsion. People have different ideas, whether it's fusion energy, which you've heard a lot about in other contexts, because fusion, you could generate lots of energy, and, you know, it could take you, maybe you could get close to going there in 50 years. You know, which means that you have to have a different kind of a ship or a vehicle that lasts a very long time, that's very big and have lots of people in it. Or you could say there are people who talk about antimatter, that you can go much faster. People have created antimatter in CERN. So it's different energy systems. There's even a person who, there are people who are looking at, yes, those warp field things and sort of loopholes in physics. But, you know...
Those things are real?
There people think that there may be loopholes that allow us to do it, and they're working on that. But here's the thing. You know why this is important? Is because when you have such a difficult challenge, just the distance challenge, it means that you have to think about the world much more boldly and much differently than if you're doing little incremental steps. And those changes, those successes and knowledge that you have, come back and we can use them here on Earth right now today. So it's that grand challenge that pushes us further. That's the reason why it's important to think about something like interstellar space. So, because it's going to make us think a lot harder.
For your mission aboard Endeavour, you were in space for a little over a week. Is that right?
I was in space for over a week, right.
So if we launched a mission to a star system, what are we talking about? How long do you have to spend in space to get to 4.3 million light years away? 4.3 light years away.
4.2 is Proxima Centauri, and that's at Proxima Centauri. And that's even if we intend to go there, because there may not be anything exciting to go. but you're going to have to spend a lot longer period of time. The way we're looking at the kinds of things we can think about now, you know, we're probably talking about, you know, decades. right? Which means that the ship all of a sudden has to be self-renewing. It has to be very big. We have to understand ecosystems because you can't carry all the food you need, right? You're going to have to grow some. So you're going to have to learn a lot about life. So we always say that, you know, part of our issue is, as we start to figure these pieces out, we start to impact what we learn about the world today. In fact, everything we need to know about interstellar to be able to successfully mount a mission to another star system are all the things we need to know to successfully live on this world as humans. You know, we have to learn about ecosystems, recycling, materials. You have to find new sources of energy. We have to figure out even behavior. You know, because everybody who's going has to figure out how to get along about education and training. There are a lot of issues.
Andrea Bernstein in for Brian Lehrer. My guest is Dr. Mae Jemison. We're talking about her project to have people reach the stars via space travel. Listeners, are you having trouble wrapping your head around interstellar travel as a viable concept and not just science fiction? Are you excited by the prospect? Give us a call at 212-433-9692, 212-433-WNYC. And Dr. Jemison, a question about this, because I feel like I keep hearing that the space travel budget is being cut, it's being cut. So how do we pay to set up a many decades long journey to the stars?
Well, let me tell you a little bit more about 100 Year Starship, because we sort of jumped into the idea of going to the stars, which I think everybody finds fascinating, right? So here's 100 Year Starship. Our mission is to make sure that the capabilities to send a humans to another star system exist within the next 100 years. That doesn't mean we're going to mount a mission. And our organization is completely is a non-governmental organization. So we're going to be working on the strategies, the ideas, the ability to make this a global aspiration so that we can develop the funding, the systems to do the kinds of research that are needed. We're not going to necessarily do the research. We're going to advocate and support for other people to do it. To do some of the work, we're going to be trying to understand what's needed, how to, you know, get all those pieces in place in case somebody decides to launch that mission. But our task is to make sure that every step of the way, as we try to solve the problems, meet the challenges, that those capabilities are applied back here on Earth, because it's really the real reason DARPA wanted to do this is because of all the technological innovation and creativity that comes out of solving really difficult problems. And space exploration is one of those that sort of captures the imagination.
You held a 100-year Starship public symposium in Houston last month. How'd it go? Are you seeing signs of excitement, support hoping for?
It went really, really well. I was very excited because we sort of jumped out of the box holding the symposium. We had somewhere around 280 to 300 people come from around the world, in South Africa, China, across the United States, Russia, Europe, Australia, South America, lots of places. And we talked about things ranging from that time-distance problem, like warp drives and how do you get there, how do you communicate, how do you avoid things where you're going really fast, all the way to things like how do you finance something like this? How do you finance and keep something going for at least 100 years or long enough to actually make the technologies and the capabilities come to life? We had science fiction LeVar Burton, who played Geordi LaForge, who was a really big, everybody was very enthusiastic to see him, but he's also the host of Reading Rainbow and has done a lot of work to advance how we think about ourselves and the world. Miles O'Brien was there. We had an engineer on a panel who had actually seen the Mercury and the Gemini programs all the way through International Space Station and had been designing for them. So, and we had people who were, you know, marketing folks. So there was a real gamut of kinds of activities. Dr. Janetta Cole, who is the curator of the She's the executive director of the Smithsonian Museum of African Art, because they had an exhibit called African Art and the Cosmos, because, you see, all of us around the world have been excited about space exploration. So what we're trying to do in our whole process is to keep that energy, to keep that emergence, that reemergence of space exploration alive, to be able to harness it
All right,
as we move forward.
Let's take some calls. Let's go to Tom from Brooklyn. Hi, Tom. You're on WNYC with Dr. Mae Jemison.
Hey there, Mae. Thanks for taking my call, guys. I'm really obviously interested in the technology and everything that we, you know, develop moving forward. It's going to be amazing, but I'm curious if you have an opinion on maximizing our present technology. If there was consensus on budget, if we all agreed this was the most important thing to do, what can we get out of our present day technology?
Well, you know, right now we've got incredible amount of things out of our present technology. In fact, we had one session that looked at space applications. There was a group called project called SEVIR, S-E-R-V-I-R, that's done what NASA does in developing countries, where they use remotely sensed technology from space, remotely sensed images, where they help groups look at land management and things like that, and deforestation they've been in. They've actually had these countries working on programs themselves and training them. So in Panama, in Kenya, Nepal, they set up programs to come back and sort of use that. Every day, the technologies we use, and we just forget about global positioning satellite systems, GPS, those are satellites in space, weather satellites. We can run that gamut of things. But we can also take a look at things like the improvement of fuel cells. There's a lot of work that has gone on in terms of developing fuel cells, because once you get out in space, you know, you send vehicles up, they have to generate their own electricity. So we've learned a lot about fuel cells. You know, those really great images that you see of Venus and of Mars, where you see the land surface, those are digitized images. In some kind of way, that information has to be made into something that we can see in our eyes and recognize. That same kind of computer programs that analyzes those, that digital data, is used for stuff like MRI scanning, because, you know, that's a lot of electronic signals that have to be made into images that people can understand. So every day we see these things applied. We just don't necessarily connect them with space.
Let's take another call, and thank you for your call, Tom. Let's go to Vane from Beacon. Hi, Vane. You're on WNYC.
Hi. I've always been a fan of the space program and the technical developments that have come out of it. One of the things I'm working on right now, though, is a project called Project Hades, which is to tap the power and the energy in our Earth for green energy to replace nuclear coal, gas, and oil. And it's if we would address it like we did Apollo, where we focus our energy on finding out how to drill anywhere in the Earth, anywhere on the Earth, and tap the heat to do deep geothermal power, we could power the Earth and green and without any pollution, any greenhouse gas releases or anything. And it just needs some engineering, like the Apollo project did to get men on the moon.
Dr. Mae Jemison, can you comment on that?
Well, I think that what you're talking about is really the fact that we have to imagine more and do more than we're doing now. So when people talk about, you know, an Apollo-type program or a Manhattan Project-type program, we're focused in on something we really want to do and we put the time and effort to do it. That's because we pick a challenge that's difficult. So there, you know, whether you talk about using geothermal power, you know, or whether you talk about using solar energy, collecting wind energy, it does require a focused engineering effort. And I think that's one of the tasks that we have right now. How do we get back to doing things that are really require that kind of focused commitment from the country, from our society? And I should say that sometimes people think of these things as exorbitantly expensive, and they probably aren't as expensive as we imagine that they are. We can do some things in a time frame and with amount of money that we don't blink an eye at in other spheres, but because we say, oh, that's futuristic, we want to hold back. You know, at some point we should say, is it worth 1% or 2% of our national budget to just think about and work on doing these much more difficult tasks that are going to have an incredible impact on us, maybe in the next 15 to 20 years or even the next 30 years? but we have to start now.
Vane, thank
you. That's one of the things we need to look at.
Vane, thank you for your call. Let's very quickly, Michael from Queens, we've got about 30 seconds.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to ask the doctor, how do you actually plan on safely getting space explorers across other star systems when they're more than a light year away safely? Is it through cryostasis? Is it through a warp drive, so to speak? How do you actually plan on doing that, doctor? Thank you.
Well, I don't have the answer, and that's what we're working on right now. There are life science issues. There are other issues. So if you really want to follow along, what I invite people to do is to come on and be a part of this journey with us. This is not just about rocket scientists and billionaires. It's about lots of people being involved. You can go to 100YSS.org, 100YearStarship.org, and find out how to participate. We're going to be building this story. We're going to be figuring out what are the life science issues, what are the social issues, what are the behavioral issues, what are the good old technological issues like propulsion systems and energy systems. And I want you to be a part of it.
Think this can happen, Dr. Mae Jemison? How optimistic are you?
I'm very optimistic that we will have the technology in place. Why? Because if you think about it, in 1901, when H.G. Wells wrote First Man in the Moon, that was really fantastical then. You couldn't even imagine. We, less than 70 years later, had a human on the moon. And our technology development, our knowledge build right now is much faster than then. It's orders of magnitude faster, so I know that we have the opportunity to do it.
All right, and you're an established Trekkie, but this is not Star Wars to you, clearly. Dr. Mae Jemison.
It's about how do we create the future today. We believe that pursuing an extraordinary tomorrow creates that better world today.
Thanks
but
so
you
much.
Have to start.
Dr. Mae Jemison is an engineer, physician, entrepreneur, professor-at-large at Cornell University, former NASA astronaut, and now she leads the 100-Year Starship Project. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck.
Thank you.
Andrea Bernstein, in for Brian Lehrer. Stay with us.